Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you to the Bay Area to speak with Luis Sohoyos, Academy Award-winning director and founder of the Oceanic Preservation Society. Luis, I am so excited you're here with us today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kira.
So let's start by talking about this Oceanic Preservation Society that you founded. You founded it after years of working with National Geographic as a photographer. I'd love for you to just start by telling us about the experiences that led you to creating this society.
Back in the early 90s, I was doing a story on the information revolution for National Geographic as a still photographer. That was what I was doing before this. And then as part of that story, I was trying to film a guy, photograph a guy by the name of Jim Clark. He was the Steve Jobs of our generation. He started, three companies from scratch and made them worth over $1 billion. But he was really a genius. He helped send man to the moon when he was just in college, when John F. Kennedy called to put an American on the moon by the end of the decade. He was working up at Boeing, and realized that the computers he was working on were too slow. It would never happen. So he asked his boss permission to speed them up so they could make that happen. He sped them up by 20-fold. When he worked at Stanford University, he was he started the first 3D graphics engine. He built that. So for the way that you can design things in 3D and in real time, that gaming became possible because of that. The day he quit that, he started Netscape, the first commercial internet browser. The third $1 billion company was WebMD. And he was too busy actually to be filmed when I was working at National Geographic. But later on, when I started working for Fortune magazine, shooting covers mostly for them, I got the assignment to photograph Jim when he's building this boat that was, the world's tallest mast. And Jim, we hit it off. We were in Amsterdam, and he said, "Louis, would you teach me how to be a good photographer?" I said, "Jim, I'll teach you how to be a great one if you teach me how to be a billionaire." And what we would do is, he'd pick me up on his plane, and we'd fly around the world, and we would go on these diving expeditions all over the world. And remember, this is a guy that I really looked up to him. He was one of my heroes, and now he's my best friend. And we would go diving, and he'd say, "Louis, I want to take you to the best place ever I've seen for diving." And we'd fly to Papua New Guinea, spend a day and a half, on his boat, getting to this dive spot that he remembered from 10 years ago, just being, the most, the Garden of Eden, underwater world. And he dove on it, and it was complete rubble. It was disappeared. And, over about a decade of doing this, every time we came back to a place, it'd be degraded. We were in the Galapagos for the third time, and we saw fishermen illegally fishing in a marine sanctuary. And Jim turned to me and said, "Somebody should do something about this." And I said, "Jim, how about you and I?" And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, we'll use your money and my eye, and we'll make films." And, I really had no business being a filmmaker. I always wanted to do it, but I didn't have, any experience. But he became, when I knew him, he was just a millionaire. Then he became a billionaire. And I started out this new project to make films. And we were down in the Caribbean shortly after that. And I was like, all excited to start this new career. And my son starts playing on the beach with this other kid. Happens to be Steven Spielberg's kid.
Oh, wow.
And Steven comes over to the boat with his family. And, Jim's computers were used to, make Jurassic Park. So there was a twofold reason that Spielberg's came over. Steven wanted to meet the father of his, son's new friend. And he wanted to meet Jim. And I said, "Mr. Spielberg, do you have any advice for a first-time filmmaker?" And he said, "Yeah, never make a movie involving boats or animals."
And, that went well.
Yeah, that was actually done in private. Jim didn't hear that. I thought, oh, my God, Jim's such a practical person, very much more pragmatic than me. But the first film we did was The Cove. And The Cove involved, obviously, a lot of boats and animals. And it became the most winning documentary in history, I'm told, won over, 75 film awards, about 100, awards around the world with, the environmental awards. But more importantly, that film, which is about dolphin hunting in Japan, created a lot of change. You know, it wasn't just the awards. I didn't even know there were so many awards in the film world. I really didn't. When we went to Sundance, I told everybody that, you know, all the crew that worked, there were like 18 main people that worked on the film. I said, well, anybody wants to come to Sundance, I'll pay for the way, you know, pay for the lodging. In my naive mind, because I'd never made a film, I'd never been to a film festival in my life, I thought, oh, how expensive could Park City, Utah be? Well, it cost me like $48,000 to house everybody for the week. Yeah, it was like, it was crazy expensive. And obviously it hasn't gotten any cheaper, but I was anxious to get everybody out of town. It's like, you know, after 3 or 4 days of the screenings, I was like, okay, let's all get, let's move out of here. And then Fisher Stevens, the producer, said, aren't you going to stick around for the awards? And I thought, what awards? You know, I thought getting into Sundance, you know, was the award. I mean, there was like 9,000 entries and they only take 100 films. I thought we had, you know, gone through this gauntlet. He said, oh no, there's awards on Saturday. So we stuck around and we won the audience award. And then it went on and just had this incredible trajectory. But at the time they were killing about 23,000 dolphins and porpoises a year for human consumption in Japan. And, you know, as much as you in Western culture, we might think that, you know, isn't that just, you know, awful? But, you know, the other part of it that was just horrible was that all dolphin meat ever tested in Japan has been found to have toxic levels of mercury, anywhere from 5 to 5,000 right. times more mercury than allowed by Japanese law if it was a fish. But of course, it's dolphins are mammals. But they were, you know, they had a plan in this town of Taiji. The mayor has had this plan hatched where he's going to, they were giving it away to schools for school systems. And in Japan, you have to eat everything on your plate. So they were being force-fed toxic dolphin meat. And, you know, the film and the activism around that stopped that. And now I think for the last year that sort of been reported, you know, dolphin kills for human consumption, it's like 610 dolphins were killed and about 1,000 porpoises. So it's down like over 93% since we began the film. So, you know, making that film, I realized that film is, you know, it's such a powerful weapon. You know, you have 90 minutes in the theater to watch, you know, and get your, it's almost like your DNA gets changed. And by the way, we didn't just, you know, this wasn't just an American experience. We, you know, behind the lines, we sent a copy to everybody that lived in that town of the movie in Japanese, you know, 3,444 copies in 2 suitcases. We took it over there and had Japanese activists handwrite, you know, personalized copies of the film and send it to everybody that lived in the town. We sent copies of Blackfish, another film about, you know, dolphins in captivity and the Cove, to everybody that worked at a consulate or an embassy, Japanese embassy around the world. So, you know, so we weren't just making a film, you know, we're not making movies, I tell the crew, we're just trying to start movements. And to that end, I think movies are the most powerful weapon in the world. You know, I call them weapons of mass construction. You know, you drop a bomb, you kill people, you make a film, you create allies. And that work still goes on to this day. You know, we don't just make a film and walk away from it. We're always trying to solve an issue. We're working right now on a series about orcas in captivity, and we'll be going to the Northwest. So this is, you know, the Cove is 10 years ago, you know, in January that came out and won the Academy Award. We're still working on this issue to this day. We're working a lot. You know, the joke is that I started the Oceanic Preservation Society initially in Colorado. And I used to joke to everybody that said, like, what's the Oceanic Preservation Society doing in Colorado? I said, well, we're conveniently located between two oceans. But now I'm actually looking at the water right now. And you know, we're right at the edge of the water in San Francisco. And we have a nice operation here. And most of our funding happens around, you know, people that live in the oceans and the coast. So we decided to move to the coast. But, you know, we've expanded from the oceans to land. You know, the second film we did was called Racing Extinction. And because we wanted to scale it up, we thought, okay, this incredible amount of success by looking at this little tiny cove in Japan. And to me, the cove wasn't just about the cove. The cove is really a way to look at what we're doing to the ocean. So it's a film about overfishing. It's about the toxicity. Why are these dolphins full of cadmium, mercury, lead, you know, the most toxic, you know, elements in the world? It's because of what we're dumping into the oceans. And that those toxic heavy metals bioaccumulates from plankton all the way up to the tropic, six tropic levels of the food chain until you get to, you know, the level, let's say, swordfish and dolphins. And, you know, those animals have a, you know, a million times more toxicity than the surrounding water because they bioaccumulate. And, right. You know, so in a lot of ways, what we're putting into the ocean is coming back, obviously, to haunt us. And so we decided, well, let's, you know, I had a, when I worked at National Geographic, I did four stories on the Anthropocene, or, you know, I'd say the four stories, I should say, on extinction. And, you know, so a lot of my friends are paleontologists. I'm comfortable looking at deep time, that the world isn't, you know, 6,000 years old. It's actually, you know, 4.6 billion plus. And, you know, we're just, humanity is just one blip on this radar. We've only been around, you know, for, depends on what you consider civilization, for a few tens of thousands of years being, you know, semi-civilized. And when I was working at Geographic, one of my, you know, close friends, Michael Novacek, the head provost of the American Museum of Natural History, told me that we're going through a mass extinction right now. You know, there's been five mass extinctions in the history of the planet, you know, going back, you know, hundreds of millions of years. The last one, 66 million years ago, when a comet hit the, you know, the Yucatan Peninsula, you know, wiped out all the large dinosaurs. And he says, oh, we're going through one right now that could be just as equally as catastrophic. You know, by the end of the century, E.L. Wilson, you know, the famed biologist that coined the, you know, the term biodiversity, said that we could be losing half the species on the planet. And, you know, this sent a shock through me. Like, yeah. My God, this is going on in our lifetime. You know, we think of a mass extinction as being like, you know, like a really bad weekend for the, you know, like when a comet hits the planet. But when you speed that, you know, relatively short lifetime of what we're doing to the planet now up, let's say, by 100 years, it could be equally as catastrophic. You know, there's several drivers of extinction. It's not a comet. This time we're the, you know, we are the comet, you know, habitat destruction, pollution, invasive species. It's all contributing to this sort of, you know, I'd say like a bad, you know, when you condense it in time, like a bad weekend for the planet. So we did a film called Racing Extinction, and which is about, you know, this planetary crisis that we're facing right now. And it was seen on Discovery Channel. I didn't realize it at the time, but they have like access to 2.5 billion human beings. You know, it's the biggest network in the world. And they did something unprecedented. They opened up all their channels to the film, and they showed it in 220 countries and territories, starting in New Zealand. This is like 4 years ago now. And 36 million people saw that film on just the first day. And what was, you know, but that's really not enough people that you need to create change. There's some really good science that shows to create very rapid change, you need 10% of the population to be 100% committed to an idea. And, you know, the studies that this, you know, these are scientific studies, and they looked at them looking at the suffragette movement, Arab Spring, civil rights movement, and 10% of the population be 100% committed to a cause is what you need to ignite social change. And I called up the lead author of that paper, and I said, well, what's with 10%? Why not 7 or 17%? And he gave me this. He sent back this whole list of computations, his algorithms, and, you know, math that they use to calculate this. And I said, he called them back, and I said, can you give it to me in, you know, layman's terms? He said, yeah. So he said, it's like, if you're trying to create steam, you'll never be able to do it unless you get water to a boiling point. 10% of the population being 100% committed is the boiling point for the spread of social ideas. So, and that's kind of, I think, why the Cove works so well, is because it reached 10% of the population. When I worked at Geographic, one of the first story that I proposed for them was on garbage. This is back in 1981, I proposed that story. Back then, there was only one mandatory recycling program in all of America. And I thought, well, this is crazy. We're throwing all of this, you know, this single-use items out there, and we're not reusing them. That became a cover story, 35 pictures on the inside. It was a really big story for this time. And it, you know, it helped start a water cooler conversation around the country about recycling. And it became part of that conversation to get, you know, more communities to have legislation to, you know, to do recycling. And, but, you know, back then Geographic had 11 million subscribers. It was about at its peak. And for every subscriber, about 4 people saw it. So it's 44 million people. That's like 15% of the percent of the population. So, and I'm not saying because that article, you know, came out that it's, you know, it was the reason we started, you know, recycling in America, but it became part of that conversation. It became part of that chorus, you know, so to ignite, you know, that 10% of the population. I didn't know it at the time, but now that's how I look at it. It's like, this is all just kind of math in a way. You use the heart and the soul of a film to try to create action. You know, that's at OPS, my organization, we don't, like I said, we're trying to create this action. It's not enough to get, you know, people into a theater to watch your film, you know, to stream it. It's like, you know, in the Hollywood, they say that films are $10 in a box of popcorn. You know, it's just butts and seats. And I don't look at the audience like that. I look at it as minds and seats, that we have an opportunity to use the filmmaking process to convert or to sway people to change. You know, we're at this, you know, we need a course correction, a pretty dramatic course correction to get the way we live, you know, custodians of the planet. We're not that. We're sort of like bad campers, you know, where we leave the campsite, you know, degraded for the next person.
Yeah. So what do you think causes that? You've made these films and you've bumped into the people that are kind of on the other side of this belief system, right? You're bumping into people that are poaching and people that are harming the planet. What do you think is causing that lack of concern on their part, both by leaders and government, but also just by the average community member who's maybe in that 90%?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, because, you know, I think if you look at poaching or, you know, the people that are the profiteers from this, I think that there's going to be always a certain amount of the population that's going to be working out of just their, you know, self-serving, like the Koch brothers. You know, they're Jim Clark, he knows the Koch brothers, and, you know, I asked him why. It's like, how can these people be, you know, these are MIT, you know, engineers. They're smart people. They know what's going on. He says, well, yeah, they know it. They told him that they're just, you know, the earth is screwed up and, you know, it's going to go that way anyway. Why not profit while they can on the way out? That's the way they think. It's just,
wow.
You know, you can make excuses for greed and, you know, your selfish reasons. But it's important to remember that most of the population is good. I mean, it was really good. I'm doing a film right now. I've been spending the last 6 days. I'm doing a film about a conversation with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu, you know, two of the great spiritual leaders of our time, of their different faiths, you know, Buddhism and Christianity. And it's like a, you know, it's a really cool thing to do, to be able to, you know, in essence, sit in a, you know, and listen to what they say for 5 days straight, when they're talking about exactly this, you know, how do you find joy in a world of sorrow? How do you reconcile that there's, you know, ISIS or, you know, this degradation going on? And, you know, they said, well, that's true, but, you know, we always get this, the news that, you know, of the worst, but, you know, that's not human nature. Nobody starts out their day saying, I think, you know, how can I destroy things and make, you know, I think most people are here to try to make the world better. And I think that there's a, you know, I think to answer your question, the bigger, there's people like the Koch brothers that, you know, obviously know what they're doing, but there's also, you know, the most of the population that might be informed now, but they don't know quite what to do. These are big existential problems that we have never had to confront before. And, you know, sometimes people think, well, it's too big. How am I going to change the climate? How am I going to stop species extinction? How am I going to do this? But, I mean, of course, you know, if everybody, you know, the name of our campaign for erasing extinction was just start with one thing, because one person could have a huge amount of impact on just their own little ecosystem. You know, you look at, just looking at what people eat, you know, we're primarily meat eaters in this country. It's, you know, 95% or more of the population eats animal products. We probably weren't built to eat animals, to sustain ourselves in animal products. You know, people say, well, the paleo diet, but like, you know, the Paleolithic man lived at 25 years old. Why would you want to emulate somebody that, you know, had a life expectancy of, you know, like that much older right. than a teenager? And, you know, we know now that a plant-based diet is, you know, you can live to over 100 without chronic diseases. And, you know, the so-called blue zones, people that do just that, they lived to over 100 without chronic diseases. 95% of their calories come from a plant-based diet. I'm doing a film series right now on just that. And, you know, Dr. Dean Ornish, he reversed heart disease with a plant-based diet. He reversed early stage diabetes with a plant-based diet. He reversed prostate cancer with a plant-based diet. Right now he's trying to reverse Alzheimer's, for which there's no known cure, with a plant-based diet. To step back a bit, you know, if you look at the blue zones and Dr. Ornish's program, it's not just a plant-based diet that's like reducing stress, you know, through meditation or an exercise, and also a social network. You know, we're social creatures. When we become more lonely and fractured from our culture, we're not, you know, there's a mechanism in us that we feel better when we're giving, when we're becoming more human, when we're giving back to others and not thinking of ourselves, we feel better. You know, this is something that, you know, I think people like the Koch brothers don't really understand, that, you know, they might say, oh, well, energy is really good for humanity, you know, but, you know, we're providing a service. Well, that was true, but it's no longer true. And to inhibit the progress so mankind can survive and thrive and live to be more compassionate and giving to future generations, they know now they've made a choice. They made a choice within themselves to sacrifice the good of humanity for their own personal, you know, rise. So, you know, there's a repercussions from not just culturally, but spiritually, individually. I think people suffer when they're not in service of community. If you're not giving back love, if you're not creating more than you get, then I know this is kind of oxymoronic, but the more you give, the more you get. You know, you create space for more giving. You know, if you think about that, it's like, when I worked for Fortune magazine, I photographed, you know, at one point, seven of the top 10 richest people in the world. I photographed people that made too much money for a living. And I can't say that they were all miserable people. There's a lot, but, you know, a lot of people, you know, they learn that you can't, I think it was Andrew Carnegie who said, you know, with great wealth comes great responsibility. And, you know, he said, if a man dies with wealth, he's the poorest man in the world. And it's because people realize that it's not about wealth. It's about giving back. It's about creating communities, educating, having more compassion and love in your life. And when you do that, everybody thrives. And, you know, it's the tenet of every religion. It's the, you know, right. And whether you're religious or not, instinctively, it makes you feel good, you know, and the stuff that we think makes us feel good, like, you know, in a materialistic culture, big houses, you know, fancy car, a great amount of wealth, it feels empty because it's not serving what it really means to be human.
So I love this idea of do one thing. Can you give our listeners some ideas of what that one thing could be? Like, what are some simple things that people can do just to get going to support this movement and support even the work that you're doing?
Well, let's go back to a plant-based diet. You know,
okay.
the average person, you know, in America consumes about 10,400 animals in their lifetime. So let's say you're 40 years old and you're going to live to 80. You're saving 4,000 animals from a life of suffering. The average vegan saves about 3.5 tons of carbon dioxide, about 9,000 square feet of wild spaces that don't have to be turned over for cropland, for food, for animals that you're in turn going to eat. You're saving hundreds of thousands of gallons of fresh water a year. It's the biggest single source of air pollution. You know, the list goes on. That's just one person becoming more plant-based. And then you could just do the math, just look around you and, you know, count the people in your office and think, oh God, you know, if everybody became more plant-based, not only are you going to live healthier with probably a lot less chance of chronic disease, you're going to be, you know, having this other downstream effect, you know, in the wake of every human being is like this huge amounts of consumption. So just creating that one thing, you know, when I was in Colorado, I had 120 solar panels on our roof, and then I had 3 electric cars. And, you know, I used to sort of like, because I was running the business out of my studio in the backyard, I had sometimes my bill for electricity was like $1,000 a month. Well, those went away. I didn't get electric bills. I got electric checks for excess power consumption. You know, the license plate of my car said it was a 2007 Toyota RAV, a fully electric SUV, one of the best cars ever made. And the license plate said VUS, stood for vehicle using sun. It was the opposite of an SUV.
I love that.
If you have to drive, you know, electric vehicles are here. If you can power them with solar, it's even better. Walk where you can. You know, the things that we used to think that were sacrifices are actually upgrades. You know, electric cars used to be expensive. Now they're going to, you know, have parity very soon with gasoline cars that when you amortize them over the cost of, you know, over time. Food's another huge one. Reducing plastic waste. You know, I don't like to tell people exactly what to do, except on a plant-based diet, because I just know that, you know, we spend $3.6 trillion a year in America, 6 times more than we do on defense, on healthcare, which is really sick care. 80 to 85% of the chronic diseases that we have, of that money, is unnecessary. It could be reversed or go away if people developed a plant-based diet. So, you know, that's kind of my crusade right now is just, I love people to find their own one thing that they can do. You know, there's a lot of them. A lot of them I'm not thinking of. But I concentrate on food and health right now because I realize that you can check so many boxes off by becoming more plant-based. Mm-hmm. You know, it's great for the environment. It's great for animals, both wild and domesticated animals that we're going to consume or get their milk from. I mean, it's a win-win-win all the way across the line. But, you know, I would put that back at you. Most people, I'd say, like, find out what you're good at. You know, we need multipliers. Mm-hmm. We need people that, you know, we need more podcasts. We need more information out there. If you're a writer, write. If you're a photographer, take pictures. If you're, whatever you're doing, there's probably some way that you can adapt what you do to help the bigger cause. You know, a lot of people are already doing that, but I think the more that we can think about community, how do you make things better for the community, the better you're going to feel, and the closer we're going to get to whatever that peak is that we're looking for. You know, the singer Pete Seeger, who was as a folk singer from back in the 60s. I met him back, I guess, in the 70s. He told me the story of, like, he said, it's an Indian parable. He said, it's like, you know, community is like we're all trying to push a log up a hill. And there's always people saying, oh, push at this end of the log, push it, we need more help over here. He said, well, if we just keep on pushing wherever we can push, eventually it'll get over the hill. So in that respect, you know, I'd say, you know, push on the plant-based, become more plant-based, but push wherever you feel that you can do the most good.
Yeah. I have a question for you about the Cove. It was one that I was personally very curious about, and I want to make sure to ask you. So, you know, in this film, for people who maybe haven't seen it, who absolutely should go and see it, you had this just incredible underground mission to film what was happening there because that had not happened before. And I am curious, when you watch the actual footage back, because you touch on this briefly in the film, but you didn't really go into it, I'm wondering if you were surprised. Like, what was it? Did it meet sort of the horror of what you were expecting, or were you even surprised to the extent of what you were seeing? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. We weren't surprised. We were shocked. I mean, I remember the footage came back, and there's actually a scene in the film where we get Rick O'Berry out of bed, and he comes down to our room in a robe, and we basically just started up the cameras. And we had these four. These were the first hard drive cameras ever made. So, you know, people that haven't, you know, this is 10 years ago. Back then, these were tape drive. People had tape drives. These were the first issued cameras that ever came out with hard drives. And so we put enlarged hard drives in them. They were 30 gigabytes at the time. And we had these batteries batteries only lasted like an hour. So we had to have these sort of expedition batteries that you used to climb Mount Everest that were wrapped together. It almost looked like dynamite. There were these huge batteries that we put inside these fake rocks that we stashed in the cove. 4 hours and 10 minutes of runtime. And we'd start these at 3 a.m. because that's when we'd sneak in there. And, you know, at 3:30 a.m, the fishermen start to wake up. So we had to be out of the cove by 4 latest, because if somebody saw our car driving around town, very small town, they would be like, who are these people? And, you know, and instantly call the cops. So we snuck in there, planted them, and then they would be sort of, you know, running in the dark for, you know, 3 hours before anything happened. And I remember the first time we ran them, I could hear voices, and I thought, you know, because we were doing tests and stuff and try to figure out like how long can these things go. And we could hear voices, and I turned to one of the guys. I said, do you forget the, you know, sort of reprimanded him. I said, do you forget to erase the hard drive? And I realized that the camera, he set the camera right down in front of a campsite where the fishermen, not a campsite, but a fire pit. And these Japanese fishermen, you know, the whalers, were sitting around talking about, you know, they're ready to exterminate a big pod of pilot whales. These are pilot whales are actually just large dolphins, about 1,000-pound animals. And these guys were sitting around talking. And when we had it translated, it was incredible, because these pilot whales are spy hopping. You know, they're in the cove behind them, with their heads coming up, and, you know, because the pilot whales are trying to see what's going on. And, you know, one of the guys says, oh, that reminds me of sperm whales. You used to see them horizon to horizon, you know, back down in Chile. You know, it was like a clump of bamboo. That's what we called it. And blue, and old timers start talking about blue whales. Oh yeah, I used to see blue whales, you know, there was thousands of them, you know, and my arms would be so tired because, you know, they were so hard to exterminate. And that was shocking. But like when we actually saw like how they were killing these animals, it was, you know, this fear, you know, shot through me like, oh my God, this is horrific. And when the world sees this, this is going to, you know, this could stir enough, you know, indignation that, you know, we could stop this. And then, you know, the fear I had was, you know, now we got to get this stuff out of the country. And so we set up a system of runners so that, you know, one person, their job was just dedicated. Now, remember, this is 2006. And there wasn't even a way at that point that you could get the you know, the zeros and ones, the bits, and translate this, have a way to edit this and put it on a screen. We had to wait another year before we could.
Wow.
Before we could, you know, use that information and translate it into a program that you could actually turn into a film. So we had a runner. We put the hard drives into an air conditioning vent. You know, we'd unscrew it every night when we came back and store them up there. Then we'd have a runner the next day when they came, go to the airport and get it on either DHL or FedEx. And so that we were never caught with more than one day's worth of footage, because we realized that we don't want to have a stash of hard drives and have the whole expedition be ruined. So, you know, but then, you know, remember that then when we got back with this footage, there was just no way to even transcode it and to put it into anything. Then we had to wait for a final cut to, you know, figure out a way to take this new digital footage and, you know, put it into a program so we could actually edit it. So yeah, I mean, it was shocking when we saw how they kill these animals. And, you know, but you know, people say, "Oh, the Cove, I can't watch it." But what they don't realize is that it's not, you know, we took out most of the horror of that, of what actually they do back there. I mean, as bad as that may seem, you know, it's not as bad as what we had to leave out of the film because nobody would see it then. And I hate, you know, by the way, I hate horror films, you know, and I avoided them. And when I was a kid, you know, I never watched a Hitchcock film. And I forced myself to go back and watch all these films that I refused to see when I was a kid growing up. And I, just to analyze them, well, how can you take horrific footage and make it so that people see it? And, you know, you look at Hitchcock, you know, the infamous scene in Psycho where, you know, there's a, you know, the victim and the perpetrator and the, you know, in the shower scene, you never really see a blade puncture the skin. You see the aftermath, you hear the music, the screams, but you don't ever see a blade plunge into the victim. And the same way with the Cove, you never see a spear go into a dolphin. We always have a, you know, either water in between them or, you know, you see the aftermath. And, you know, the mind fills in probably too good the blanks. You know, people are very empathetic. They can sense the horror. You know, there was, so a lot of the imagery that's the most horrific is stuff that it's actually not even that violent. You see a baby dolphin jet out of the water and land on the rocks and fall at a fisherman's feet and kind of surprise him, and then it rolls back into the sea of blood. And, you know, it's such a mind-bending, horrific image that things are so horrible that this dolphin shoots out of this bloody sea onto the rocks. And, you know, in essence, you're just seeing a dolphin, you know, land on the rocks and fall away, but you're imagining the horror. Another scene was, you know, a friend of mine, Charles Hamilton, helped put a camera underwater. So we always thought, well, what's it look like from underwater? And there's a scene where the water turns from green to red, and that's not doctored. It's not digitized, you know, to make it look red. It actually happened. And you see all the scene is this, you see some poisonous catfish come up. And then you hear in front of the lens, and then you hear the fishing boats come, and you hear the dolphins screaming underwater. And then you see the water turn from green to red, and you don't see a dolphin, but it ushers in, you know, the horror, you know, but that's mostly surreal. Another horrific scene. It was actually kind of, you know, oddly, horribly beautiful. There's a scene where all the dolphins are killed, and Simon Hutchins put one of these rock cameras up in the woods, and so you see this, you know, the green leaves of a tree, and the cove is completely red. It looks like something like, you know, brighter than beet juice. It's just surrealistic. And again, it's not colorized at all. We didn't touch it, you know, for on color temperature. And so you just see, it's like the calm after the storm, right? So you're seeing this, like the ripples of the water, which should be blue or green, and now it's, you know, bright red. And out of this red comes a fisherman, because they sent the Japanese fishermen of Taiji, they send in these divers to go. The dolphins, when they're killed, they don't float to the surface. They actually, you know, go down. They're on the bottom. So they send these divers down to look for the dead dolphins. And this diver comes up out of this red, and he looks around, and he goes to see where he is because he can't see anything. He's probably feeling in the mud. Then he dives back down, and you see his yellow flippers, you know, disappear into the red sea. And it's like, oh my God, you couldn't have invented something more poetically horrible than that. Except maybe one of the last scenes in that sequence is again, this goes back to that camera where you started out at, you know, watching the fishermen, you know, and warming themselves by a fire while the dolphins are in the background, you know, looking around at the horror. And one of the divers at the end of the scene, he goes to the cove and he picks up a coffee can and half a gallon and fills it with water. Now the water is red. It's full of blood, right? So he puts this blood on the flames to extinguish it. And then it turns into, he sort of disappears behind the smoke. And it's like, and I looked at that scene and I thought, and cut. It was like, you know, and all this stuff was just like, it's still shocking, you know, to look at it. And it's, but it's not as bad as people think. When people look at it, say, oh, I can't see the cove. And, you know, people can. I mean, it's a...
Well, and they need to. They need to see it, because otherwise then we're just burying our head in the sand and pretending it doesn't exist, as opposed to being forced to look at what's actually happening and then being challenged to do one thing about it.
Yeah, well, and it's also important to remember that, you know, the dolphins in that industry, they're also... That's most of the swim with dolphin programs and the dolphinariums around the world come out of that cove still. So they stopped killing a lot of them. As many as that they used to, but the industry that really supports it is the captive dolphin industry. There's 25 new dolphinariums opening up in China in the next few years. 19 this year are opening up, and a lot of those dolphins come from Taiji. So we banned them from coming into captivity in America now, but you know, these are animals that have, in a lot of cases, they have bigger brains than us. They have another section of their brain that's used for echolocation. They're, you know, they have more convolutions of gray matter. So there's more neurons. People say, oh, well, they're not as smart as us. They don't use computers. Well, they don't need to. They're, you know, they have a stronger social system than us. You know, an orca, you know, a male orca will, you know, won't go much more than a body length away from its mother its whole adult life. So the social systems are very, you know, intact and primal but they're very sophisticated. And, you know, we look at them and, you know, we subjugate them to do entertainment. You know, Jacques Cousteau said the educational benefit of watching a dolphin in captivity would be like learning about humanity only by watching a prisoner in solitary confinement. You know, I think when you take an animal out of the wild and you force it to do tricks for our amusement, it says a lot more about our intelligence or lack of it than it does the dolphins.
Absolutely. Well, Louis, I want to wrap up because I know you've got to get going, but I would love for you to just tell our listeners how they can follow you and support your work. So give us your websites and your handles and any ways that people can contribute or be a part of the just amazing films that you're making.
Well, we're at, the Oceanic Preservation Society. It's opsociety.org. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. That's the best way.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us today. It was just a pleasure to get to talk to you and hear all your awesome thoughts on the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it, Kara.
So for those of our listeners who have not yet watched The Cove or Racing Extinction, I highly recommend them. As Louis said, they are movies that create movements. My quote today is by Edward Abbey, and I actually stole it from Louis because it's at the bottom of the emails that he sends, and I thought it was really appropriate for this to go on his episode, especially since it clearly comes from his heart. The quote's by Edward Abbey, and he says, "Action is the antidote to despair." So as Louis said today, even if you start by just doing one thing, you truly can make a difference. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us next week. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge. Please rate and review our podcast. 5-star ratings and good reviews really do help us make a successful podcast that can be a part of making the change that we want to see in the world. So help us out, throw us a great 5-star review, and we look forward to speaking with you next week.